Welcome to Licking on Leadership.
The purpose of this program is to bring to you interviews with industry leaders.
A weekly podcast bringing you leaders of the real estate and mortgage industry.
And I can't think of anyone better to join me in this role of providing this co-hosting role than one of the top leaders in our industry, and that's Mark Jones of AmeriFirst Mortgage Banking Group.
And here's the host of Licking on Leadership, David Licking and Mark Jones.
Listeners, I am so excited to have with us today Jack Guttentag. Jack is a professor of finance for the Wharton MBA School for years and is also best known in the mortgage industry as the mortgage professor. He is in the greater Philadelphia area, and it's just a real honor to have him join us today. Jack, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on the program.
Before we get to the interview, we'll have just a quick word from the sponsor that makes this podcast possible. Did you know that the impact from Hurricane Harvey, Irma, and Maria has caused historic damage to thousands of homeowners in the impacted areas? The results reported by Black Knight's data and analytics team state that there were 4.38 million mortgage properties within the Harvey and Irma FEMA declared disaster areas. An estimate of just over 400,000 mortgage properties in Puerto Rico as a whole and the entire territory has been declared. Altogether, these properties represent approximately $755 billion in unpaid principal balances. Identifying properties damaged by these devastating storms is cumbersome and time-consuming for servicers. So in order to help, Black Knight has introduced disaster tracking capabilities within its LoanSphere MSP servicing system. The new functionality actually sweeps servicing portfolios to quickly identify properties in FEMA-declared disaster areas. If you want to learn more, call 844-474-2537 and you can ask Black Knight or email askblackknight@bkfs.com.
Jack, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on the program.
Dave, thanks for asking me.
There's so many reasons I respect you and have admired you and enjoyed our friendship that's developed over the years. There's so many things I want to cover, but the mortgage professor is so well published and so well known. I can't imagine that people don't know who you are. But for those that might not be familiar with you, let's let our listeners get to know you just a little bit. First of all, I want to start off by saying you are a part of the greatest generation, according to Tom Brokaw's book, The Greatest Generation to Ever Live. That means that you went through the Depression and you fought in World War II, and I believe that is in your background, correct?
That is true. I was a child during the Depression.
Okay.
But I became a teenager, and I was 19 when the war broke out, World War II. So I'm very much part of a war generation. I was in school when it all happened. I was going to Purdue looking to become an engineer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was my first inclination, and I give the Army credit for giving me the time to reflect about that and about that choice. And when I went back after the war, I had changed my mind about becoming an engineer. I decided I wanted to do something in the social sciences. But as for your previous question, how did I get into the military? They were drafting people right and left. The Army came around and told us that if we joined the Army Reserve, they would let us finish our college education. So that sounded like a good deal to me, and I joined. And at the end of the semester, they called me up.
Okay.
I learned then that you could never trust anything that the Army ever told you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure. So you didn't get to finish your college education until later, but it, as you said, it did give you time to reflect on what you were majoring in and why. And so, you know, originally, where are you from? What part of the country are you originally from?
I was born in Brooklyn, New York, but at the age of 4, the family moved to New Jersey.
Okay.
So I grew up in Englewood, New Jersey.
Okay.
Yeah.
So graduated from high school there, went into the university, and you also have a PhD. Is that in economics, correct?
Yes, that's in economics at Columbia.
So how do you go from engineering to economics? And how did behavioral science fit into that?
The interest gradually emerged when I went back to Purdue. Purdue was my undergraduate degree. After the war, you had to go back to the college that you came from.
Okay.
I would have preferred to have gone to a liberal arts school. Purdue was heavy on engineering, but they had a lot of liberal arts courses, and they had a particularly interesting set of economics professors there. And I took all the economics courses that that they offered because I found I liked them. And that interest just emerged during my university time there, and I decided that was the area that I wanted to work in.
So then you acquired your doctoral degree in 1956, if I'm looking at my your LinkedIn profile correctly?
I had finished my coursework at Columbia a couple of years earlier. I took a couple of jobs. I worked for a short time at Prudential. I didn't like it there at all. I worked for a year and a half at the FHA. I was offered a position at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which I took. I stayed there for 8 years. That was a great experience, a great learning experience for me. I moved up their ladder there and could have stayed on and made the Federal Reserve a career stop. But I decided that basically I wanted to be an academic, and I took a salary cut and moved to the University of Pennsylvania in 1962.
So then you were their professor there for, gosh, how many years? I mean, 1962, and technically, I guess you're still there as a professor emeritus. Is that correct?
Yes. Emeritus means that you're still a professor in some sense. I became emeritus, meaning I stopped teaching courses in 96, although I continued to teach an executive education course in housing finance for the International Housing Finance Program.
Okay.
And in fact, I have done that right through last year. Whether I'll do it again this year or not remains to be seen. We have a great international finance course. People come from all over the world to take it.
It's wonderful.
And I really enjoy teaching it. I've cut down the number of the number of sessions that I teach, of course, but I still go over there.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, you were married for 62 years, and I just learned that your wife of 62 years, Doris, who I had the privilege of having dinner with the two of you not that long ago, had just died this year, and my condolences to you and that. But you have two children, and I think there's some really great stories about them, one of which went off to Hollywood and did well. The other one, if I understand correctly, is a doctor, correct?
Yes. One is a radiologist. He's a kid who knew what he wanted to do from early on. He's always interested in puzzles, not research. Research is too long-term. He liked short-term puzzles. Right from the get-go, he was oriented in that direction, and he found the perfect career, which was being a radiologist, because a radiologist, that's what he does. They solve short-run puzzles. They look at the test results and make a judgment, and then they go on to the next one. That's my younger son.
That's your younger son. Okay.
Yeah. The older son was the one we worried about because he was an indifferent student. I had to swing a lot of weight to get him into the University of Pennsylvania because he was not a good student. But somewhere along the lines in his senior year, he acquired an interest in film and went out to Hollywood. I staked him for another year taking a course in the American Film Institute, and he embarked on a career making documentaries in which he has been quite successful. He's been nominated for Academy Awards four times, I think, and won twice. And
so four nominations and has won twice from the Academy.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. The last time he won for an episode that he did on what was called, it was called Twin Towers. It was on 9/11.
Oh, wow.
It was a real winner and was shown in the White House. So he and his wife and others were guests at a White House dinner in which they looked at that movie. So so that was quite exciting for him.
I love the stories of kids who know what they want to do, focused on it. That sounds like our youngest. And then our oldest, who had no, still doesn't know exactly what she does, but is pursuing those hearts. And we'll see, it's interesting where their paths take. But I love that story. I remember you told me that when we were at dinner, and I just love the two stories because it's a contrast. And I think it represents so many opportunities and represents definitely two large segments of probably every generation that's ever been. Those that want to know what they do and those who are trying to figure it out. And so, Jack, you've had a distinguished career. So many of my friends in Wall Street that went to Wharton just loved your classes on finance and economics and housing. And in fact, several of them tribute you for their career choices to go into housing. And we're going to get later on, we're going to talk about the HECM programs, the reverse mortgages, all of those area things. But I want to go to a story that's near and dear to my heart. It's where I first connected with you in a meaningful way. I've known of you for years and respected your writing and you as a person. But we really connected in Madrid, Spain. Tony Moss, at that time Eurocatalyst, invited us both to come over to Madrid and speak. And I believe there's many European ministers of finance as well as three top mortgage companies from each of the countries there present there. And again, I believe this was 2007 or 2008. I'm not sure the exact year on that. But Tony, who's become a very dear friend of mine, said, there's Professor Jack, the mortgage professor, would like to have dinner with you. And he said, why is that? He said, well, I don't know, but he's going to be seeking you out. Just be prepared for the conversation. I said, okay. So I share the story so many times, Jack, because you found me. We connected at the reception, and you said, Dave, I'd be interested in buying you dinner. And I said, why is that? And I said, be honored to, but why is that? He says, well, I hear you're an entrepreneur. And I said, yes, guilty as accused. I definitely have been an entrepreneur throughout most of my life. He said, well, I'm thinking about starting a business. Now, Jack, at that time, you were 85 years old. I said, Jack, most guys 85 are planning their estate and planning to their grave plot. I mean, how long do you plan to live? And with a twinkle in your eye, you said at least 5 more years. And I said, how is that? With a chuckle. And you said, I have a 5-year business plan. And I told you at that point, I'm adopting you as a member of my family. I love that attitude. We went to dinner and we had a wonderful conversation, and you did launch that business and it did very well. I'm 66 years old, and I look at how many people decide that they're over, they're done, and they quit. And they quit learning, and that is not you. Professor Emeritus, still, from 1962 on, while you cut back, you still stayed active in the business. And I want to talk about that, because many who are going to hear this interview are going to focus in on that unique story. Every time I tell it, I get a lot of laughter, but admiration. Some get challenged. I wanted to get your thoughts. Where did that start, Jack?
Well, I think it starts with your career choice. I briefly alluded to becoming interested in economics earlier in this conversation. Within that field, I developed some varied interests that engaged me. And one of them was in all things housing and mortgage related, which was one of my areas of interest right from the beginning. In fact, my PhD dissertation was called Some Studies of the Post-World War II Residential Construction and Mortgage Market.
I realize that.
Yeah, and it was a series of essays that I had written for the Federal Reserve Bank of New York on different aspects of the market. I also, of course, was very much interested in money and banking and monetary policy, as one would expect from being inside the Federal Reserve System, and that was an area that I spent a lot of time on. Those were areas that excited me personally, professionally, and when you're excited by a subject matter, you want to be continuously engaged, and age is not a barrier, so long as you still have the capacities that you need to pursue these interests. Now, you do have to make some concessions, and the major concession that I made over the years was in reducing my sphere of interest. Gradually, over time, I did that. And I think perhaps a good illustration of that is with the courses that I have taught at various times in my career. In 1950, I took a year off to teach because I wanted to see whether teaching was something that I wanted to do with my life. And I taught for the year in a small college, Elmira College in upstate New York. And my course structure was as follows. I taught 2 semesters of history of Western civilization, 2 courses in principles of marketing, 2 courses in principles of economics, and 2 courses in elementary statistics, 1 and 2. That was my set of courses. When I went to Wharton a number of years later, my course load was money and banking, corporation finance, and housing finance. Along the way, I cut corporation finance. That had become so heavily specialized that I didn't want to give it the time that was needed to really stay up with it. So I cut that one out, and I limited myself to money and banking and to housing finance.
Wow.
And that was true right from to the time I became emeritus. And when I became emeritus, I was involved in a business venture, which was all mortgage-related. It was a mortgage software company that I had started with a colleague and which was doing okay at that time.
It was GHR. You're referring to GHR.
Yes.
And you had that from very successful company. Anyone doing anything in the capital markets, that was the gold standard at that time, and it survived for a long time. It was from 1989 to 2005, and then I believe it actually continued to live a life after that, because Alan was doing that with you, if I recall correctly.
Yes, your memory is right on. We sold in 2005 to a firm called Metavante.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that sale illustrates something else that I always keep in mind and have always kept in mind through my life, and that is that there's some things you can't control that affect very importantly how you do in your life, how things work out. And you can call those fortune or you can call them luck, but they're things over which you have no control. And selling our business in 2005 was one of them, because if we had waited another year and a half, the value of the business would have been a third of what we sold it for.
Right. Timing is so much.
The timing had nothing to do with my perspicacity at all. It was just dumb luck.
That's hard to imagine for someone with a doctoral degree and a teaching award. It's hard to believe that you'd make that statement. But there is some real truth to that. I mean, oftentimes it'd be better to be lucky than smart or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
But and you definitely hit it on the right timing, because it wouldn't have taken much longer with what ensued. When you're interested in housing finance, I started in 1973. You started with teaching at Wharton in housing finance, narrowed it down. But from 1962 and even earlier than that, I guess, you have had a real interest in the housing finance. I would love, and I think our listeners would really appreciate getting a historical perspective of where we've been, where we've gotten to, and as best you can, pick to where we're going, or give us insights what you think where we're maybe headed with our housing finance. And if you have any recommendations you would say to those that are setting policy and laying down the foundation for the future, what should that be? Give us that whole perspective.
Oh, boy.
I know. That's probably a weekend.
That really...
Well, let's start with where it was. Let's start with back then. When you entered the housing finance system, we did not have, if I recall correctly, I'm looking at the timing, I'm recalling a lot. I have a dateline because I do a lot of public speaking on this. But we did not have Freddie for sure. I know we had HUD and FHA, and somewhere, I can't remember exactly when Fannie Mae came along, but that back then was in its infancy of the secondary markets. Secondary markets didn't really start until the 70s. So talk about those early years, and where do you, as it relates to where we might be heading?
Well, Fannie Mae actually was chartered in 1938.
That's right.
They were chartered because the FHA program, which had started in 34, was having difficulties because lenders were not willing to accept FHA mortgages. They didn't really have trust that the government would actually insure them. And so they set up Fannie Mae to buy FHA mortgages. That was the original purpose of Fannie Mae. And, of course, all of that changed over the years.
What do you think about that system? I mean, that the system, it worked. It's been there to kind of help bolster housing and encourage housing finance in America, creating liquidity for the housing market, which has given the engine for growth that we've seen. That system, does that still work today? It is working. It is. You look at the amount of, you know, how dependent we are on Fannie, Freddie, and HUD. Is this a good thing, or should we be getting concerned that we've taken a good thing too far?
Well, as you know, the role and operations of Fannie and Freddie changed drastically over the years. They became secondary market entities.
Right.
Across the entire market. Freddie Mac originally just dealt with savings and loan associations, but that went away, just like Fannie Mae started out as purchasers of FHA mortgages. That went away, and eventually they became competitive secondary market agencies that sold their own securities, which were similar but not identical, to the investors all over the world. And these securities were purchased because they were assumed to have the backing, indirectly as it might be, of the federal government, which of course turned out to be the case. The securities turned out to be good, despite the fact that Fannie and Freddie, for all practical purposes, became insolvent in 2007-2008. Now they're in this state of limbo where they're, in effect, wholly owned entities of the federal government, and nobody quite knows what to do with them, but they just have to have them because there's no other secondary market sources out there.
Yeah, we've become highly dependent upon them at this point. And is this system, I mean, is this going to be a system that's going to survive, or do you see some new opportunities? You look at what things are going on in Europe. I mean, how much have you studied this? And what do you see the potential opportunities for change here?
Well, opportunities for change in this area are so heavily political that it's very difficult. The system of secondary markets is badly designed right now. We have these two federal agencies that are generating a large market, but it's a market for federally government-insured securities. And the private market doesn't amount to anything. And the reason it doesn't amount to anything is that we don't have the right institutions involved in that market. What we have are a bunch of loan originators who are specialists in originating loans, but get rid of them very quickly thereafter. And we have institutions that will take loans and package them up into securities and sell the securities, but they don't want any involvement in those securities after they sell them. They want to be out. And that's the problem, because every private mortgage-backed security out there stands on its own feet.
Right.
It has a credit enhancement built into it, but if that turns out to be inadequate, there's nobody around that's going to take responsibility for it. And that turned out to be a fatal flaw in the private market, and it still exists. This is in distinction to the way it works in Europe, especially in Denmark, where mortgage-backed securities are sold by entities, depository institutions, that are responsible for their mortgage-backed securities.
The institution is their guarantor.
Yes, the issuer guarantees every security. Their liabilities on its balance sheet.
Right.
That's the way their system works. And they have never had a default in Denmark. There's never been a default on a mortgage bond. So that's the system to emulate, but there doesn't seem to be any political constituency, let alone a private market constituency, to push that kind of an approach.
What obstacles do you think there are in the U.S. to adopt such housing finance or securitization or liquidity model such as what we hear, what you described, or what is there in Denmark?
Well, I'm not sure that you would call them obstacles. There's just a lack of interest. Like the mortgage banking industry in the United States, which has been going on for a long time, is well established. They have their mode of operation, their structure, their mode of financing, and everything is geared to a particular type of operation, which involves originating loans for sale. And for them to become mortgage banks would be a major change, something that they really find it hard to contemplate.
Right.
They don't have the capital to begin with to be a mortgage bank. As loan originators, they have a limited amount of capital because they don't need much capital, and they don't need much capital because they don't hold much on their balance sheet. The only thing that's on their balance sheet is what's in the process of moving through. So they would have to raise capital and enter a new line of business. That's very different. So there just isn't any interest in the industry in doing that. And I'm not sure where the impetus for this kind of change could occur except in the political arena. And given the state of that arena today, I wouldn't be very optimistic that anything like that will happen.
Yeah, not much chance of innovation happening. You're chairman of something of an organization called the Upfront Mortgage Brokers Association. We've talked about that on several occasions in times past. Tell our audience a little bit about that association. What brought that association about?
Well, somewhere along the lines, I became impressed with how important mortgage brokers had become in the loan origination process. And at the same time, I became impressed with the drawbacks from a consumer perspective of dealing with mortgage brokers. Not all mortgage brokers, but some mortgage brokers. Some mortgage brokers are a lot better than others. They're more efficient, they're more trustworthy, and there was no way for a borrower to distinguish one from the other. The big stumbling block was the mortgage broker's compensation, which was a kind of residual that he took out of the transaction without the knowledge of the borrower. So typically the borrower didn't know how much the broker was making on a transaction. That's the way the market worked.
Yes.
The idea behind Upfront Mortgage Brokers was that these brokers would specify their fee to the borrower, like any independent contractor selling a service. They would view themselves as selling a service, which was their help in getting the borrower the best possible deal, because the broker dealt with multiple lenders and they understood the market and they could negotiate, they could find the best deal among a group of wholesale lenders that they dealt with, and they would have a price for doing that that the borrower would know in advance. So it was a very simple idea. It got some traction, but it pretty much fell out of bed with the housing crisis.
Right.
As we speak, there's only really a relatively small number of brokers that are still hanging on to the designation. They still have the website. They have a website which lists who they are, so it's still possible.
I think it's still applicable, though. I mean, the need to be up front about that. Now, Dodd-Frank and the LO compensation and how things are disclosed mitigated some of that, but there's still, from a marketing standpoint, from a real opportunity here to focus back on that a bit. Wouldn't you agree?
I don't know. There are now very strict compensation rules, and the last time I looked at them, they were very complicated. What they came down to, and I'm a little hazy about the details right now, but as I remember, what they came down to was that brokers had to declare the commission that they charged with each of the wholesale lenders that they dealt with, so that it was no longer a matter of negotiating the price with the borrower, or their ability to negotiate the price with the borrower is now constrained by the requirements imposed by the lenders, which are in response to the new regulations. So I haven't been doing anything on Upfront Mortgage Brokers now for some time, and the organization still exists. It still has its website. There are still some members, but it hasn't been active.
Well, I'd love to visit that topic again, because I can see reason why that is now becoming needed, which really goes to the point. History repeats itself. You know, what we fail to learn from history, we're doomed to repeat. Do you see the potential for another housing crisis to come in? And if so, how, when, what's your thoughts on history repeating itself? Because it seems like we're heading back in the direction of what got us there. We're not even close to what got us to the last housing crisis, but the pendulum seems to be moving again. Love to get your thoughts on that.
I don't see any housing crisis emerging. We've had two of them in this century. We had one during the Great Depression, and we know what that was about.
Right.
That didn't originate in the housing sector. It originated in the economy and in the banking sector, and it spilled over into the housing sector where you had price declines and enormous numbers of foreclosures. That was the first of the housing crises. And the second one, more recently, in 207, 208. You could say this one really began in the housing and mortgage sector and then spread out to the rest of the economy. And the prime mover in the crisis was the housing bubble, a period of sustained price increases in housing, which lasted long enough and were large enough to generate a set of attitudes toward what was normal, which had the effect of making people do all kinds of crazy things that in a normal market they wouldn't have done, making loans to people who really didn't have the capacity to make the payment on the assumption that, well, they'll be able to refinance the loan in a couple of years, and if the worst comes to the worst and we have to take it back, the house will be worth so much that we won't lose any money anyway. The bubble was the prime mover. Now, don't ask me what caused the bubble, because that nobody seems to have much of a handle on. It seems to originate in some mysterious fashion. But the bubble was the prime mover, and it caused a complete erosion of underwriting standards that
right.
that affected not only lenders but also the secondary market agencies that ultimately had went along with it, bought these loans. So that was the second crisis.
Right.
I don't see a third one.
I think the regulations are such that it's going to be very difficult to see another housing crisis, especially when we see, look at the millennials coming on. I mean, they're just entering the housing market a few years later in their years than probably a previous generation, but there was good reasons why that is. But we're definitely seeing them come on. It's just the beginning, and they already represent 35% of all first-time home buyers, and that segment's going to be growing dramatically. And again, so I think we see solid growth there. I think it comes back to monetary policy, and which goes back to your days when you were at the New York Fed. And if you look at monetary policy of the Federal Reserve today, love to get your thoughts. Are you a fan of it? Concerned about it? What are your thoughts about the current monetary policy?
Well, we've been waiting for years for interest rates to go up.
Right.
We've had this prolonged period of low interest rates. They haven't been this low. You have to go back to right after World War II when rates were pegged to find anything comparable. And it seems finally that it's starting, and rates have begun to rise. I have mixed feelings about this. You have to accept the necessity for a rise if you agree with the prognosis for the economy that most of the slack has been taken up. And
right.
if we're to avoid inflation, we have to start tightening the valves. When you think of the implications of that, they can be largely negative in terms of the impact on home buying. I have a particular concern about the impact on the reverse mortgage market, because higher interest rates, once they get above 5%, the amount of money that you can draw on a HECM reverse mortgage starts to go down.
Right. I want to talk about that and get to the HECM, because that's your latest passion or interest in your studies and what you're doing right now. One of the reasons I think we had the housing bubble that was created the first time, it goes back to policy. And what happened in the Carter administration was the need for CRA, Community Reinvestment Act. It started there, and we've seen it go along its way, and then home ownership, and this is not political statements at all. I mean, or political opinions one way or another, but it was really during the Clinton administration, we saw the focus and the importance of building home ownership as a big initiative, and I was all for it. I mean, I saw the potential, but we took that too far. And so I think the genesis of this whole housing bubble started back when we took something that I think we had was well-founded and was initially had some strong merits, and that was the CRA program, encouraging banks to lend in areas that they were avoiding. And then we took it to another level and trying to find the wisdom on how to keep any policy, whether it be Fed monetary policy or housing finance policy with the government, and keep it within certain boundaries. I would love to get your thoughts and any wisdom you'd like to make sure that the next generation keeps in mind based on all your studies on this of how can we control the extremes of heading into
too much money flowing into the markets. What should be our guiding principle on that? Any ideas?
The extremes that we reached during the bubble period, which came out of explicit congressional policy,
right,
were setting targets for the federal agencies, Fannie and Freddie, regarding what proportion of their home purchases had to be for borrowers of low and moderate income. And they came up with those targets that got higher every year. That was a major factor. We're not doing that anymore.
No. There's some more attention being given to the rate of home ownership. I mean, the Mortgage Bankers Association is focusing on that we are at the lowest rate of home ownership. You know, it's not a huge difference, but it's the lowest rate of home ownership in decades. And so that is of concern in a sense. But I wonder if that's not going to change as we see the millennials getting employed, forming households, and household formation bringing on the next generation. The birth impact that has, because that seems to drive housing. The market, we get married and want to start having families, that really drives housing, and regardless of demographic uniquenesses in there.
That's all natural, and we expect that to happen. The market has to expand to accommodate the demand, but what we're really concerned with is housing policy, government policy, and how it responds to those kinds of pressures.
The government intervention in housing policy, is that a good thing, or is it, again, one of those things where probably little is okay, but too much creates these potential catastrophes?
You have to take these policies one at a time. It's bad policy for the government to require federal agencies to purchase a specified percentage of loans to a particular type of borrower. That can only be troublesome. So we're not doing that anymore, and that's a good thing. On the other hand, some of the lessons that were, and I put lessons in quotes, that were learned from the crisis were bad and are hurting us now. One that particularly gets in my craw is the requirement that all mortgage borrowers, have to provide full documentation of their income. This was a rule that was stipulated by the agencies at the very end of the bubble period and is also found in Dodd-Frank. What that meant was that a whole set of alternative documentation requirements that had evolved over decades and which made a lot of sense, where people in different situations could provide different documentation or less documentation for which they were charged. If it was less documentation, they would be charged a higher rate. There was a pretty well-crafted set of requirements. That's all out the window now. Full documentation is the requirement. And what the group that has been hit hardest by this are the self-employed,
right?
Because they have the most difficulty in providing documentation. I have a whole file of emails from self-employed borrowers who told me stories about being unable to get a mortgage loan, despite the fact that they could put 30 or 40% down and had credit scores in the upper 700s or low 800s. Good credit, large down payment, but they still can't get a loan. That makes zero sense.
I absolutely agree. Well, let's talk about the other end of the spectrum, and it's the baby boomers that are retiring. You have recently been really focusing on the reverse mortgage, and if I recall correctly from our previous conversation, you're a big fan of those programs. Why?
The HECM program is a well-designed reverse mortgage program. There's nothing like it anywhere else in the world. Reverse mortgages are a tough instrument for private lenders to make, and you're not going to get a program like that except as a governmental sponsorship program. The strength of the program is that it provides seniors with a range of options that meet a variety of different needs. They can draw cash if they need it. That's not the optimal use of a reverse mortgage, because reverse mortgages are really designed to allow people to continue living in their homes And so the focus has always been on providing support over the years, but if someone needs some upfront cash, they can get it. One thing they can do with it is they can pay off an existing mortgage balance if they have one. If you take a HECM, you have to pay off any existing mortgage balance. So they get rid of a mortgage payment by doing that, and that can be a big help. Alternatively, you can draw a monthly payment from the HECM. You can draw it for the period you're in the house. As long as you're occupying it, you get the payment. Or you can draw it for a specified period, 5 years, 10 years. If the period is shorter, you can draw more. Alternatively, you can take a credit line. A credit line is exactly what it says. It gives it's a right to borrow at any time. And if you don't use it, it grows. It grows at the same rate as the loan balance. So if you have a $100,000 credit line today or at closing, 1 year from now, it will be equal to $100,000 plus the interest on $100,000 plus the mortgage insurance premium. It'd be more like $105,000, $106,000. The credit line is the most powerful feature, the HECM. There are no other programs anywhere that I know of that offer credit lines. It's what borrowers who need a reserve for contingencies or for unexpected expenses or occasions like a wedding, you take a credit line, and so long as you don't use it, it grows. You can use it at any time. One of the hazards that people are going to be facing, people who retire increasingly in recent years, is the hazard of outliving their money. A smaller and smaller proportion of the retiring population have defined benefit pension plans that pay them a certain amount for the rest of their lives. Those are gradually disappearing, and a declining proportion of retirees, those entering the retirement years, are really well equipped financially to, in the sense of having enough to live another 15, 20, 30 years. So there's a fear, even those with a nest egg and a substantial nest egg may still have a fear of outliving it, depending on how long they live. Well, the credit line under HECM is a good insurance policy against that. You let it run, and if you die before you need to draw on it, well, you still have money in the bank. Your estate gets the house almost free and clear because you'll owe very little. On the other hand, if you live to 100, you'll be able to draw on the line.
It provides liquidity to seniors that, based on the equity in their home, where they wouldn't otherwise have access to that. In fact, an increasing number of people are using this in a very wise financial management planning tool. And I think we're seeing more financial planners get in and get excited about the product. They start out questioning it. They're dubious about it. But then they understand it, and they go from being, this is the worst thing for seniors, to possibly this is the best thing for seniors. What was that moment for you that caused you to just go, wow, this is an amazing product?
Well, my interest in reverse mortgages predates the HECM program.
Really?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I published a monograph called Creating New Financial Instruments for the Aged in 1975.
Oh, really?
I had several articles before that and some afterwards. So I had an early interest in reverse mortgages. There were a number of programs around that I was involved in before the HECM program. There was one in Buffalo, New York called Help in Buffalo, which was a small-scale reverse mortgage program. And then there was the American Homestead program, which operated primarily in New Jersey, which was what's called a split equity program, a part, mm-hmm. part loan, part equity sharing. It never was very successful, but it was interesting. There were a number of small depository institutions that had programs designed like HECMs, except that the borrower had to repay the loans before they died.
Okay.
So those weren't very, very promising. And then the HECM program began in the late 90s. Right from the beginning, it had this feature of providing alternative ways to draw funds, including the credit line method.
Right.
Which
you're the biggest fan of. That's the
which
features.
I'm a big fan of, yeah.
Yeah, good.
So the downside of the HECM is that it's a very complicated instrument. It's much more complicated than a forward mortgage, and the typical senior has difficulty understanding it. It was with that in mind that I began my second business venture, which is heavily focused on the reverse mortgage market. So we now have a Heckam reverse mortgage calculator, which I call the kosher reverse mortgage calculator.
Good, the kosher. Where can they find that? Where can people or listeners find that?
What's that?
Where can our listeners find that calculator? Is it online somewhere? Is it?
Oh yes, it's on. I have two websites now, and
okay.
Calculator is on both of them.
And what's the two websites?
If they click on reverse mortgage on the homepage, they'll see it. One site is mtgprofessor.com,
okay.
And the other is kosher-reverse-mortgage.com.
So MTG, abbreviation for mortgage, professor.com, and you can find it there. That's the one website I go to the most often. I want to make sure our listeners know where that's at. So MTG, again, the abbreviation for mortgage, and then professor.com. So check that out, listeners. What's the advice that you would be sharing for those that are getting ready to retire? What would you say to this generation that's retiring? Anything, words of wisdom you would share with them that would inspire them to keep on giving back, such as you have?
Well, when you're retiring, it's already a little late to start preparing for retirement.
Yes, it is. Yeah. You're there.
You make your preparations earlier when you choose your occupation and what you want to spend your life on. If you have made a good choice of what you want to do, then there's no reason to stop doing it when you get older, because this is what you like to do.
Exactly right. Yeah. And that's where you fall. In fact, you said there's basically two camps. First of all, you said it's good to start when you're young. You just made that statement. And then there's really two camps. It's those that have the privilege, are fortunate enough to find something they love to do. And you said find someone who is willing to pay you for what you love to do. So there's that camp. You were fortunate to get into that camp. But then there's that other camp you talked about. There are those that are taking over family businesses that are not fortunate. They may know what they love to do, but they're not fortunate to get into it. And for that group, they spend some amount of time pursuing a career, running the family business and passing it on or whatever. But then they do retire. But at that point, they can then at that point get to doing what they love to do. Am I correct?
Yes. More people fall in that camp probably than in my camp. But I live in a retirement complex in Gladwin, PA.
Yep.
And a very significant proportion of the residents here were physicians.
Interesting.
Yes. And physicians can't really follow my advice, because you have to be licensed as a physician and you have to have a place to practice.
Right.
And so the practice, the tendency of physicians is at some point they will retire. As soon as they retire, they're done with the practice of medicine.
Right.
And I find that most of them are not only done with the practice, but they're not even particularly interested in the field. And so they have the challenge of having to find something else that interests them, that they can fill their days with. And some of them manage that fairly well, but a lot of them don't. So they're really not doing very well in retirement, because there isn't much that they find that they want to do. And that's unfortunate.
That is unfortunate. And I think that shortens one's life. I think one of the reasons we're talking, and you're 93, you'll be 94, coming up on your 94th birthday.
December.
Right? Yeah. December, okay. So you're at that point where you're loving life. I look at your energy level, Jack. I look at your cognitive abilities. You are still a great critical thinker. You're working on things, and I want to use you as an example for so many. But it is true. There are some that just can't make that transition, and it's sad, because oftentimes their lives in what I would consider prematurely or at an unfortunate, it has less than a stellar end. Your ending is something to be celebrated, and which is why I wanted to invite you on this radio program. I want people to hear your voice. I want to hear your energy, your brilliance.
You do have to make realistic concessions to your age by recognizing what it is that you can do and what it is that better avoid trying to do.
So give us some examples of that.
My decline in capacity is entirely related to my memory. My memory is not what it used to be. Now,
but it's still really good.
No, well, it isn't good enough for me to be able to flash from talking about housing finance to talking about monetary policy very, very effectively.
Okay.
I can't do it the way I used to do it. And so that's essentially why I have become more specialized in how I allocate my time.
So that's a really good point. So what you're saying is throughout your career, you used to have, when you were first teaching, you taught on both housing finance and commercial finance, and then you narrowed that down to housing finance, and now you're down to a very narrow focus, but a much needed focus, the HECM program, the reverse mortgages. I see that as a good thing. But the most important part, Jack, is you haven't quit. You're staying alive and you're staying engaged with what capacities you have, and you're keeping alive. I can't help but believe that it has extended your life compared to doctors that I've had dinner with you at your beautiful facility there. I mean, it's a gorgeous retirement home. You had, when we walked through the halls, we went to and from the dining hall there, you just had a pace so much stronger than those of people that were 10, 15, 20 years younger than you. I was just amazed at how quickly you moved and how present you were. It was really fun, and I asked you about that. You said a lot of them are doctors, and I thought that was really interesting.
Well, the other part of it is that you have to keep yourself in decent physical shape.
Yes, well, you've done a good job of that too.
I get over to a fitness center just about every day.
That's outstanding.
I work on keeping myself physically up to the demands of what I do. So you can't neglect that.
But we've covered this in this interview a lot of words of wisdom for the next generation. But what would be the thing that we have not discussed that you would like to share, that you would like to say, next generation, be paying attention to this?
I tell my grandchildren to follow their dream if they can manage it.
Good.
If they can't manage it, to come back to me and ask whether or not I can help them manage it.
Good. When you say managing your dream, what does that mean to you? Managing your dream. I think we have some insights into what that might mean, but I'd love to get your thoughts. What does it mean to manage your dream?
It means to live it, to do what needs to be done to live it.
When you're in your study, as I had the privilege of sitting with you in your study, and it was so obvious what you love to do because you got to the computer and turned it on and were sharing exciting ideas. But as I looked around your study, I saw pictures of you and Doris from throughout the years of all the places you traveled. You have a wonderful seashell collection there. All these things you've done, you're surrounded by evidence of that you did, in fact, pursue your dreams, and you did achieve them, and you had a wonderful life partner. Again, I'm just so sad and sorry to see she has departed. She was just a delightful, classy lady, just a wonderful life. She was just delightful.
Yeah, well, you're pointing to another aspect of life choice and the mistake that you see made over and over again by the people who aren't making the decision about what they want to do with their life properly and put at the end of the queue that they want to travel, but they'll travel after they're wealthy enough and maybe after they retire. There's so many people whose lifestyles revolve around an expectation that at some point they're going to retire and that's when they're going to travel. I was fortunate enough to be able to pull travel into my routine. So I was able to do some consulting work abroad. I taught for a semester in Iran in 1970.
Oh, wow.
Took my family around the world in the process. We were away for 13 months. Not everybody can manage that. I was fortunate in being able to do so. But the object should be when there's something you really want to do, some place you really want to visit, do it.
I have enjoyed our time together. I always enjoy my time with you, and I am looking forward to getting back to Philadelphia and sitting down and having dinner with you.
Do that.
Well, we will, and we'll do it soon. I'll be looking at that empty chair next to you and be missing Doris, but she lives on in so many wonderful memories and certainly lives on in the walls and the pictures that are up and so numerous around your study there. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the time. As we now know you as the mortgage professor, but a dear, very dear friend and someone I have so much respect for. Thank you for being an inspiration to me and to, I believe, thousands upon thousands of others out there. Thank you, Jack, for being here and your contribution to the housing finance system and to the lives of many. Thank you.
It was my pleasure, Dave.
Truly a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Lickin' on Leadership, a weekly podcast about leaders in the mortgage industry. Tune in next week, and thanks for listening.